Blog Talk Radio.
This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. Tonight, we're talking guardianship abuse again, and we've got a special guest with us, actually, too, is Patricia and Robert Femia, and they're going to be talking to us about trauma-based bonding, what happened to her mother as she was taken into this guardianship and the effects of that. And the core of this is what we've seen many times in these cases, the immediate isolation, even though statute in every state says that, you know, it should be the last resort, it's always the first option. And no reason needed. We did it because we could. And then what happens is the grooming starts. They don't tell the elderly person that they won't allow the family to visit. They just keep reminding them, you don't see anybody else here but us, do you? I told you your family doesn't care about you, only I do. Or the nurses will chip in too, the aides. Nobody's coming to see you. You're dependent on us. We're the only ones that care about you. You better be nice because nobody's coming to see about you. And the psychological stress and damage from this, if many of you are familiar with what they call the Stockholm Syndrome, and it's where people are so terrorized and they're captive that they'll start bonding with their captors. And it's a safety mechanism. They feel like doing so in their mind, they rationalize it, that by bonding with this person, and they'll even become protective of them, they can maintain a level of safety. And this is what they're doing to the elderly. Now, you have to understand that in these cases, these people are ripped from their homes, from hospital beds, from usually very loving and caring families, as in this instance this evening, and they are absolutely shocked and terrorized, and they are dragged away by force. The police help a lot of times, and they are put into these warehouses we call nursing homes. And many times this is out without any sort of stimulation. There is no TV, there's no radio. They take away their glasses, any dentures, any hearing aids, anything to diminish their existence as a human being. And the effects of this are recognized by the Human Rights Commission as being one of the leading indicators of torture. This is recognized around the world as torture. If you look at the prison system, they can get in major trouble if they put somebody into solitary confinement for more than 30 days, and even at 30 days, you're stretching it. Now imagine an elderly person that has had this happen to them, that's been kidnapped in this system, stashed into this warehouse with a bunch of strangers who really don't give a damn about them most of the time, and your family's not there, there's no phone calls, there's no letters, there's nothing, because the guardian is intercepting everything. And the isolation from that is a form of psychological torture that most people cannot survive. If they do survive it, it is because they have identified with their captor, and it is called trauma-based bonding. It is terrorizing someone to the point that they will cling to you out of fear. And this is what happened in this case. Our guest tonight, as I said, are Patricia and Robert Femia. And welcome to the show, both of you. Patricia? I can't hear you. Hello? Something happened here. Let's see if we can get him to call back in. But this has been a long story, well documented. There was articles written about it. But what they talked about in the articles was the financial aspect of it. What they talked about was somewhat of the process of it, But what they did not touch on was the psychological part of it. What was the effect on the family? How did this affect the family? Did it damage them? What kind of damage did it do? And so we have this that we need to talk about, because little attention has been paid to that, this downstream effect. And we're waiting for Patricia to call back in here. We've had some trouble. I don't know what's going on. Okay, let's try this again. Here she is, I think. Okay,
hi, Marty.
Wait a minute.
This is Patricia. Can you
hear
me?
Yeah, there we go. Now I got you. There you
great.
Go.
Thank you for inviting us onto the show. This is Patricia Femia, and
this is Bob. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
Thank you both. Thank you both for coming on. I think we're going to be talking an aspect of this that has gotten very little attention, but it needs to be exposed. It needs to be talked about. And that was, what was the effect on your family? Before we get into that, Patricia, would you and Bob like to give just a brief history of what went down, how it happened, how you came to be in this situation with your mother?
Yes. I think there's a little delay when you talk, so hopefully you can hear me. Give a little background on how this all started. My mom was an Italian immigrant. She was born in Italy. She met my father in World War II. He was a U.S. soldier over in Italy during the war, and they got married there and came over to the, and he brought her over to the U.S. She spoke English, but my dad worked for the federal government at the VA for 40-some-odd years before he passed away. And so he was in an office. He did all the paperwork. My mom was a seamstress and a stay-at-home mom as well. And I'm my parents' only child. So there were no siblings. Some of the family was in Italy, but I was pretty much the only family member to my mother. And what happened was that they had me a little bit later in life, so they were very protective of me. And my dad passed away in 1988. At that time, he was 69, and my mother was a widow at 64. Bob and I did not have children at that point. So to keep my mother busy, because she was very, very devastated at my father passing away. I mean, he was her whole world. That I set her up in a little seamstress business, keeping her busy. She was a little bit less social than my dad, so I would make sure that I'd include her, but she did not live with us at that time. And then in 1992, my husband and I had our first child. My husband's in the pharmaceutical industry. He's a chemist by training, and I'm a biology major, and I'm a medical sales rep by training. So my mother, of course, volunteered very happily to watch my children so I could return to work. So she was at my house every day. She would come over and watch my son, and then I had two more children. So she really was the one that was raising my three children and enjoying it. My mother turned around completely. She had no more health issues, and she wasn't depressed once she was watching my kids. Later on, mm-hmm. as she got a little bit older, she was in a townhouse about 10 miles away, and we actually bought a piece of property near our house and built a house for her. And then I also have my real estate license, so I sold her old house, and she moved into the new house. And then, years later, now we're getting to about 2008, my mother started, declining a little bit, a couple of little accidents, just as she was aging.
Yeah.
And loss of hearing, things like that. And so we decided instead of that we would build a new house that had a separate apartment for her so she could move in with us. So now my mom moves in with us in 2007, sorry. And she had her own apartment, but she was in our house. And so slowly, but still driving, slowly but surely, we saw a little decline, a little bit of depression. The dementia was starting. She started having car accidents. And also, one of the things with dementia is that they become a little bit suspicious. You know, they tend
yes.
to trust the strangers sitting next to them on the bus, but their caregivers, they, you know, so she started asking a lot of questions. Now, throughout all of this, from 1988, when my father passed away, I would take care of all her paperwork or make phone calls for her or do anything office-like. And my husband, in turn, because my mother was watching my children, was taking care of her house when she had her own house, outdoor work, anything that needed repair. All these things were familial verbal agreements, right? It wasn't
right.
like, okay, you put in 3 hours here and he put in 2 hours there. It wasn't like that. It was just, and my name was always on all of my mother's bank accounts after my father died, because she said, you're my only child. There is nobody else. We should have these joint bank accounts. So when my mother sold her house and moved into our house, she basically, when the house was sold, she took the proceeds of the house and gave them to me, which amounted to about $575,000. And she basically said, look, take this money. This is to pay for my part of the house. And because ultimately it's yours, you know, to do what you want. And I decided I would put it into an account with just my name and her name rather than putting it in our family trust. Just because I said, just in case, you know, I drive around a lot, something happens to me, you'll feel comfortable that it'll come back. She didn't ask for this. So years go by, you know, she starts declining. She loses her driver's license. She had numerous accidents. Her doctor tells me you should start keeping a diary, which this at a later point, you'll see how this kind of came to bite me in the butt. And so I
yes.
start documenting all these things, okay, this diary of like some of the behavioral things that were going on. So what led us to the point where everything changed was my mother I was out working and I got a phone call that there was a police car in front of our house. Apparently she called for an ambulance. She felt like she was going to faint. The ambulance and the police come and they suspect she may have was having a stroke. So they rush her to the hospital. I jump in the car, drive back to New Jersey. My husband, the same thing after work. My children at this point, only one was home at this point, living at home. The others had moved on to leaving the house and going to college. And so we get to the hospital and they said, well, we've had her here for, you know, a little bit to observe. And we can't really find anything physically wrong with her. We can't explain why she was feeling faint. But they said, and it was, I think it was a married couple, two Indian doctors that were married. And they said, you know, we'd like to keep her in for observation. And by the way, she's making a lot of statements that we're concerned about. They're saying that she was saying she wanted to kill herself and that she wanted to kill my husband and I, and that she wanted to burn our house down. So we want to keep her here for observation. Well, what they didn't tell us was that they said we think that the best thing is for her to stay here for a night and then we move her to a psychiatric hospital that specializes in geriatrics. So we didn't know, you know, we didn't know what to say. I mean, we said, I mean, if that's what's necessary, they said they couldn't release her when she was making suicidal threats like this. So what they did was they went to, I guess, a judge, and they had a social worker and two doctors that had evaluated her that said that she was suicidal and she was making threats and she needed to be committed. And so we were kind of following along with the doctor's experts, right? And so they moved her to this psychiatric hospital. She was there a day. All of a sudden, she keels over. She flatlines. They rush her back to the hospital. Now suddenly they say she needs a pacemaker. My mother says, I don't care. I want to die. I don't want a pacemaker. So I spent 2 days convincing her to have a pacemaker. Now, if I really didn't want my mother around, I could have just said, yeah, don't get the pacemaker, right? But
yeah,
there
you go.
I could have just said, hey, look, you know, I don't really want her in the picture mm-hmm. anymore. So, like, don't take that pacemaker. That's not a wise decision. Instead, I ran around trying to find doctors to talk to her, and we convinced her that she needs the pacemaker. But the hospital staff says, listen, after you get the pacemaker put in, you really need to go back to that psychiatric hospital, but we want you to self-commit. We don't want to have to go through doing this again. So she agrees, and she goes back to the psychiatric hospital. Well, they keep her there for 6 weeks, and they drug her, and they're telling me that they evaluate her, and they show us the records, and they say she's got dementia of the Alzheimer's type and bipolar 1. So we have all this written down in the records, and they said, we can't release her. They kept her there for 6 weeks because that's when Medicare runs out. And they said, right. You can't release her to your house. She has to go to some sort of an assisted living that has a memory care unit. So, again, we were kind of following along with all this because I obviously didn't want my mother, you know, committing suicide or burning down my house. So I was running around all of New Jersey looking for a nursing home, and I'm evaluating them on cleanliness. But the big criteria was that I wanted my mother to be able to have her sewing machine because that relaxed her and kept her calmer, I think. And so I find this nursing home. It was called Paragon Village. It's now Paragon Village by Bentley. They were sold, and they're out in Hackettstown, New Jersey. And I go in and meet with the head of the nursing home, and she says, yeah, we have a room, and it's in the memory care, and we start filling out the paperwork, and she says, well, okay, do you have power of attorney? And I said, no, I don't. Do you have medical proxy? No, I don't. And so they said, well, you know, technically you're not really supposed to sign these papers then, but what we recommend you do is go for guardianship. So it's a little different here in that they recommended that we go for guardianship. And I said, what's that? We didn't even know what it was. And so they said, you know, just go to a lawyer. And she handed me a couple of cards. She says, pick one of these. They're all elder care specialists. And we go and pick a lawyer, and we go to see the lawyer. And the first meeting with the lawyer says, hey, now mind you, my mother had not been moved to the nursing home yet. Okay, she was still at the psychiatric hospital in her last few days of those 6 weeks. And so the lawyer says, hey, this is no problem. You've got history. You've been keeping a diary. You've got, you know, you're an only child. And the nursing home thinks, you know, she's a great candidate. This is a slam dunk. Those were their words. This is a slam dunk for you. This won't take a lot of time. It won't go to trial. We just go before the judge, and we have, you know, two doctors, and it's a slam dunk. And you'll have guardianship over your mom, and then she can be here at this memory care center. And they even send people up to evaluate the nursing home, and they say the same thing, dementia of the Alzheimer's type and bipolar 1. So my mother, they say, look, if she runs away or she gets violent, we can't keep her here. So you got to make sure that you don't drive her here, that we suggest you send an ambulance. So we go along with it, right? Makes sense. We didn't want her jumping out of the car. So the ambulance takes her down. The night before we go over, we move, you know, all of her belongings and clothes and, you know, things to make the room look, you know, homey. And they go, oh, listen, there was a little problem. Another person progressed up that has been here for a couple of years in assisted living, and they took the bed that your mom had that you negotiated $3,000 a month for. So we're going to put her in a different room, but don't worry, we're not going to charge you the difference between the $3,000 room and the $8,000 room. Okay. So next thing you know, I go in the next day, and my mother had been moved there, and I said, oh, great, I want to come and visit my mother and see her settling in. And they meet me at the door, and they go, listen, here's the situation. We don't want to risk her getting homesick or trying to run away, so we recommend that you don't let her stay here. It's like when you drop your kid off at camp. You don't want to go there right. and make them feel like they get homesick. And having had three children, two of which went to camp, it made sense. And I said, okay, well, how long? And they said, give it a couple days, okay? But call here. definitely call here and we'll let you talk to her and, you know, we'll, so, but then it started dragging on. It wasn't a couple days, then it was a week, then it was 2 weeks, then it was 3 weeks. And I'm like, look, I really want to see my mom. And I would call and they would say, oh, she's in art therapy now, or she's having an x-ray done, or she's this, or she's visiting with the doctor. And so there was always an excuse. So finally, after 3 or 4 weeks, I said, look, we got to go down there and see what's going on. I mean, they're not letting us see her, but like, let's risk it, right? I mean, even if she gets homesick, you know? So we drive down, and it was her birthday and Mother's Day, and we show up at the door, my husband and I and my daughter, with flowers and cake and gifts, and we're met at the door, and, you know, there's like the receptionist, and they said, who are you here to see? And I said, I'm here to see Ada Vocino. And the guy looks up and he goes, 1 minute, please. And he comes back and somebody else was with him. And they said, oh, we're sorry, you can't see your mother. And my mother was in the distance with her back to us in one of the lounges. And I said, okay. What do you mean I can't see my mother? And they said, well, there's a restraining order against you. I said, a restraining order? What are you talking about? Don't they have to give you a restraining order, like serve it to you? And they said, no, well, there is one and we're not allowed to let you in. We'll take the cake, though, and the flowers, and we'll give them to her. So now I call my lawyer, and she's like, that's not right. And there were these three big goons with their arms crossed. So it was also like not only them saying that there's a restraining order, but like it's intimidating, right? You don't want to like be rushing past these big guys, right? So the long and the short of it was I was kept from visiting my mother minimally. We started to go. But what we didn't know was when the nursing home gave us the cards of the lawyers to go for the guardianship, the day my mother arrived, they conveniently had, there was a lawyer across the street that was a sole practitioner, and he sends his wife over to pick my mother up and bring her over. He's Italian. He speaks Italian, and he starts, as you put it, the grooming process. He starts to schmooze her. What kind of a daughter would lock her mother up in a place like this? You don't belong here. And, you know, they're, of course, drugging her as well. And he starts the schmoozing. He goes over and visits her every day. He's speaking Italian to her every day. His name was Robert Scirocco, and he was out of Bud Lake, which is part of Hackettstown, across the street from the nursing home. And so he's going to visit her, and he now starts writing letters to our lawyer, which, by the way, now both lawyers came from the nursing home, so file that away. And he starts sending my lawyer letters and getting her all riled up, saying that they're going to fight it and that my mother had hired him and that he was going to take back the money that my mother had given us for her house and that, you know, I was this terrible daughter and blah, blah, blah. So we go before the judge. This was about a month later. We had this wonderful judge initially assigned to us, a woman named Deanna Wilson. She was in the probate court of, or they call it Chancery Court of Morris County, New Jersey. But she had been doing guardianships for 30-something years, and she was an expert. And everybody was saying she's going to be great because she's fair. And the minute we walked into court, she took one look at Robert Scirocco and said, oh, my God, what the heck are you doing here? Because he was an ambulance chaser. He was suing everybody.
Oh, no.
Right? Yeah. Uh-huh. So anyway, it seemed to be progressing well. She agreed that we had to, you know, get two reputable doctors. She assumed, you know, she actually called for one of the doctors that we were going to use. And reputable people that were experts in neuropsychiatry, especially with geriatrics. Meanwhile, my mother's lawyers were trying to prevent her from having any doctors come and visit her, so we had all trouble with that. And they were bringing their doctors in who were like buffoons, right? One guy was a radiologist. Another guy wasn't even board certified. Another guy administered tests to my mother and said that she failed the test not because she had dementia, but because she took them in English and should have taken them in Italian. Well, then why didn't you administer them in Italian, right? So, okay. So right. It's still going well. But then in the summer, Judge Deanna Wilson retires.
Uh-oh.
So they get an assignment judge, and he's, you know, now it's dragging out. This is like 2-3 months into it. And the fighting between my mother's lawyer, Robert Scirocco, and our lawyer, which was McEwen Macri in East Hanover, New Jersey. And on top of it now, my mother gets a court-appointed attorney, right? And the court-appointed attorney in the beginning, Richard Deignan, who was out of Morristown, New Jersey, seemed to like kind of be believing us, right, and saying, yeah, this doesn't sound right. But along the way, part of the grooming process, Robert Scirocco somehow wins him over and says, look, we got to fight this together. So, and by the way, occasionally I would get to see my mother, but when I would go see her, she would say, Robert Scirocco isn't going to charge me. He knows that, like, I'm an old woman and I'm on a pension and he's not going to charge me. And she would say these things like, he says you're a bad daughter. He says you want to put me away and never see me again. All the things that you were mentioning earlier, you know, Marty. So,
mm-hmm.
So at this point now, months are going by. Lawyer bills are going up. Originally, our lawyer said it should cost anywhere between $7,000 and $30,000 if we go to trial, okay, for us. And she said, but, you know, it's a slam dunk and it'll just come out of the estate, so don't worry. So, but we're forking over our money in the meantime. Robert Scirocco changes my mother's bank account and her pension check. And remember, she's not under a guardian yet, but the trial doesn't happen until February of the following year, okay? So almost a year later. Now, one thing to keep in mind, my mother, when she lived with us, was relatively healthy in terms of, yes, she had some hearing problems, but there was no major health problems. Although years before, she did have an empyema, and I nursed her back, because my mother didn't want to go into a rehab center. So I took off from work and I nursed her and for a month. So here's the thing. Now we find out, because of course we only get to talk to her or see her occasionally, that my mother had, they didn't tell us, but they had her go for carotid artery surgery, which is a pretty big surgery for someone who's like 88 years old. It's risky.
Yes.
So she had that.
Yes.
And then 2 months later, now we're in October before the trial, she falls down at the nursing home and breaks her shoulder and her hip. Now at 88, the numbers say that when you have two things like a break like that, your chances of survival are very, very slim. So she's at a hospital. We run over to the hospital. We were told like 2 days later, and I show up at the hospital and there's a woman there hugging her and holding her. It was the secretary of Robert Scirocco saying, we love you, we miss you. And I'm like, who's this? And so she says, are you okay if I leave you with her? And I'm like, and you are? And she didn't want to tell me who she was. And then my mother said, you can go. I can talk to her. So at this point, she's away from the nursing home. So she's in a regular hospital. And I'm like, what's going on? And she says, that's Bob, meaning Robert Scirocco's secretary, and they, you know, they had brought flowers over, and she basically says, they're my new family. They come and see me all the time. And I'm like, what are you talking about? We can't come and see you. We call all the time. We go up, come over with your grandchildren. And she didn't believe. So at this point, you know, she's very ill. They didn't think she was going to make it. And so the next morning, my husband and I go over to the hospital again early in the morning. And when I get there, the nurse says to me, oh, she said, you know, so glad you're here. You know, you should talk to the doctor. And I said, oh, okay. She said, well, he's already talked to your brother. I said, brother? I'm an only child.
What?
She said, he told me that he was your mom's son. So I run down to the front desk and look at the sign-in at the hospital, and lo and behold, Robert Scirocco had signed himself in. Well, he just wrote Robert Scirocco, but it was clearly, and I took pictures of everything. Sad that I have to do it this way, but And so I go upstairs and I talk to the doctor, and so they want to send her to rehab. And of course, the lawyers want her at a rehab close to the office so that they can be there all the time. And we're trying to push for like a really good rehab that is known in New Jersey for, you know, excellent rehabilitation. And of course, I don't have medical proxy or POA, so I can't make any decisions, you know, because my mother at this point is an alleged incapacitated person. She hasn't been deemed incapacitated. So I call the ombudsman, who had investigated us thanks to the nursing home. They called and said the Femias are stealing her money. And, of course, these are the nursing home that recommended that we go to the lawyer. And he investigated us, and he was a retired state policeman. And he said, there's nothing going on, but he says, off the record, he said, there's something funny with that lawyer. I can't say specifically, and I can't testify at the trial, but there's something funny going on there. So I call the ombudsman, and the ombudsman's office in the state of New Jersey is actually run by an attorney. It's a woman. And so I get her on the phone, and she says, listen, I said, why do we have to be sharing time with my mother with these two lawyers that are coming to visit her? This is our family. My mother's very ill. She may not make it. So she said, I'm going to tell the lawyers not to go there over the weekend. And then that's when the next day, you know, Scirocco was there posing as her son. The other lawyer, Richard Deigman, also went to the hospital and was chatting with me. And he says, he said, listen, I understand. He says, I have a crazy Italian mother-in-law too. So you can see, like, these people are heartless the way they talk about these, about my mom, the victim. Well, anyway, so that was October, end of October. So now we fast forward to November. So it's Thanksgiving Day. So I had called and told them that I was coming to pick up my mother, or to come and visit her and bring her food, because, you know, she was right out of the hospital, out of the rehab with the broken hip, and she was wheelchair bound, right, and the broken shoulder. So we drive out with my husband and I and the kids, and we get to the hospital and to the nursing home, and we say, hi, we're here to see Ada Vocino. And they said, oh, we're sorry, she's not here. So, of course, I thought, oh, my God, she's back in the hospital. And I said, well, where is she? And they said, someone checked her out. So, again, I look at the death book, and it was Robert Scirocco. He had gone there and picked her up only 2 or 3 weeks after she had broken her hip and her shoulder, and brought her to his house because for Thanksgiving dinner, I don't know if your lawyer invites you over for Thanksgiving, but I can tell you none of my lawyers ever invited me over for Thanksgiving dinner. So
yeah,
this guy had taken my mother in a frail state and brought her to his house. And according to the nursing home, they said, well, you know, he didn't want to leave her alone on a holiday. It's like, are you kidding me? Right. And so this is the sort of stuff that was going on. I'd be calling my lawyer on Thanksgiving Day saying, this guy has taken my mother. It's a complete grooming. I'm sure he was saying, look at your daughter. They're probably eating Thanksgiving dinner, or they're on a vacation, or this or that. And they leave you here all by yourself. Because that's the way my mother was believing, plus the drugs. They were drugging her. I used to look at her medication list, and it was chock full of all sorts of antipsychotics, and antidepressants. So we go through Christmas. Christmas we went to visit her, and when she was there, as we were pulling up, she was being taken out by an ambulance. She had a nosebleed. She was passing out again. I went into her room. They wouldn't let me go in the room unattended, but I went in with my trusty phone. There was blood all over from this wasn't a minor nosebleed. This was bad. And so, mind you, she also had the pacemaker. So all these things after she left my house, a pacemaker, carotid artery surgery, the break of the shoulder and the hip. And on top of it, my mother, who's normally 130 pounds, was starting to lose weight. She was slowly getting towards 100, 110 pounds. So now fast forward to the trial. The trial was a kangaroo court. It was her, Robert Scirocco and Richard Deigman, with my mother, and then my husband and I, a full week off from work, sitting in the courthouse, 9 to 5, and with our lawyer, who basically bungled the whole thing. She actually wore hearing aids, and when we got in front of Judge Coburn, Judge Donald Coburn, the first thing he said on the opening day was, he said, "I am here on recall. I was in the criminal court in Essex County." And he said, now, he goes, "This is my second guardianship case that I've ever presided over." And he says, "I have to tell you, this is very important because I've been reading about this, and I'm finding that there are a lot of greedy children in New Jersey." That was what he said at the beginning of the trial. These two lawyers bring in, like, these doctors that it was laughable. Like, the doctor saying that she didn't do well on the test because she was given in English. Like, nobody questioned, like, like, the judge didn't say, "Well, why didn't you give it to her in Italian?" Or, and the tests that she took with the doctors, the reputable doctors, she was scoring, I don't remember the name of that test, but it's like a scale of 1 to 100, and like 50, 60, you're not doing too good. She was in the 20s where she was scoring very, very bad, very low scores. So the long and the short of it is the trial goes through. We had every imaginable witness. You can imagine what the law and
Coburn put them down.
And Coburn embarrassed them and put them down and shamed all the witnesses that we had. And so it was as if we didn't have any witnesses. One witness was one of the workers at the nursing home said, "We went to visit my mother and my husband was screaming at my mother, and my husband was speaking loudly because my mother, of course, they took away her hearing aids, right? So, you know,
yes.
We had to speak up so she could hear us." And then my lawyer said, "Who was there when this happened?" And she points to my husband, she points to me, and she says, she could barely speak English. She says, "And the daughter." And I said, "Ask her to describe the daughter." And she says, "She's a blonde, and my daughter is so dark, olive skinned and black hair." So, but he didn't say anything about that. So now I'm going to turn my husband over.
I want to add something to this particular scenario, because this was one of the things that I found most interesting, and in any other venue, it would have been downright amusing. This woman who was brought to testify, who worked at Paragon Village, was a kitchen worker. Okay. Now, we were sitting with my mother-in-law in the front of the building, in the front of Paragon Village, right near the front door. Everyone that comes and goes can see and hear everything that's going on. Now, we ascertained through our own attorney's cross-examination of the witness that the kitchen area that she worked in was in the very back of the building. Yet she said she was in the front of the building that particular day at that moment in an office. Okay, and this happened to be one of the hottest days of the summer. It had to be close to 100 degrees, okay? And Paragon Village was a fairly new building, okay? So it was fully equipped with adequate air conditioning. There was no reason for the windows to be open. She said on the witness stand, "I could hear everything because it was very hot that day and all the windows were open." Okay, so she's a kitchen worker. She's a kitchen worker who works in the back of the building, who just that day happens to be in the front of the building sitting in an office that should be air conditioned on one of the hottest days of the years with the windows open. So our lawyer said to her, "Describe the Femia's daughter." She said, "She's a blonde." Okay, so at that point, our lawyer, one of the only things she did right was she turned to my wife and said, "What color is your daughter's hair?"
So we showed a picture.
We showed a picture of our daughter. She has dark, dark brown hair, almost black. It's been that way since she was a child. It's still that way today. And the judge just dismissed all of this and accepted this woman's testimony.
Well, actually, the judge said, don't be too hard on this lady because she was shaking because she was an illegal person. And so she was scared because they probably threatened her to go there and testify in court with probably being fired. But anyway, I did want to go on to what happened after the trial. Okay. So the end of the trial, they read the verdict. It wasn't a jury trial. And the judge rules that my mother was, and I'll quote him, unequivocally competent. She did not need a guardian. So we were dismissed.
Oh.
That was it. She was
unequivocally
competent. Right. Now, keep in mind that my mother had totaled her car, and her lawyer was promising her that he was going to get her driver's license back for her. And I said to my husband, I said, if my mother ever gets behind the wheel of a car and drives in our old neighborhood with no sidewalks, if she kills a kid that's walking to the bus, I'm never going to be able to forgive myself. That's on the head of the judge. But see, they don't care, okay? So because they knew they were going to keep her captive there. So what the result of that was that I had to give my mother the $575,000, which was the proceeds of her house, okay? And somehow my mother had told them that she had given me U.S. savings bonds that were about $300,000 that were sitting in my safe deposit box for 30 years, never touched. And my name was on them, and my mother's name was on them as a co-owner, okay, not POD.
Right.
And I had to turn them over. And if I didn't turn them over by 5 o'clock in the evening, the week after the trial, that I would be taken in for contempt of court. And there was a matron waiting there for me saying that was going to take me away. And so I had to turn over the bond to put me in jail, And I have I don't even have a speeding ticket. I have a clean record. And so I had to turn over the bond. I also had to turn over any jewelry that my mother had, which was always in a joint safe deposit box that we always had. And, you know, I had to turn it over. And my mother's one lawyer, Richard Deignan, signed for that jewelry. Now, what do they tell you when you go into a nursing home? Don't bring valuables. Don't bring jewelry, don't bring money, because it'll get stolen. He signed for it, and when my mother eventually died, there wasn't even a wedding band on her finger. So where did that jewelry go? So at that point then, we had to I gave over to the savings bonds. They cashed them in the next day, which caused a tax event for my mother, which ended up costing her about $60,000 the following April. But the judge said to her, listen, you don't need a guardian, but you know, your daughter, she did try to take a little good care of you over these last 30 years. So maybe you need a conservator. See, we didn't realize that that's basically the same thing. So he was suggesting that Robert Scirocco be her conservator so that he could help her with like paperwork and the things that your daughter helped you with. So the last day in the court, that was the last time I saw my mother. And I knew that they had completely taken over her, because the last thing that my mother ever said to me, and there was this article on our family in Forbes and Next Avenue. The last thing my mother said to me was, this is my new family, and my lawyers have promised me that they're going to destroy your family. And she said, I never, ever believed in the military either, and I wish that all three of your children are killed in battle. Now,
My God.
Let me tell you something about Italian grandmothers. There's plenty of Italian grandmothers that get pissed off at their daughters or their sons, and they may say, hey, I'm going to change my will, and I'm going to make it so that you don't get any of my money, and it'll go to my grandchildren. But there is not one Italian grandmother on this earth that would ever say something bad about their grandchildren, let alone wish them dead. And all three of my children are in the military, and every day I always worry, right? Because I feel like my mother put this wish on them. And my mother raised them. You know, she spent all her days with them when they were little. So why would someone say something so awful? And the two lawyers were standing there snickering, counting up the bonds. They took her out to dinner. They were saying, let's go celebrate. You know, and it was just, we were devastated. I mean, now it sounds like I'm calm and I'm talking about this story, but this was in 2013, and it was devastating to the family. I mean, my oldest son was in the courtroom, and he saw all this. So then, about 2 weeks later, after 2 or 3 weeks later, It was a month later. So what happened was that a friend called and said, "Did you see the article that was in the newspaper about you guys?" I said, "No. What are you talking about?" So I go online, and there was an article in a local newspaper, coincidentally, just like down the street from Robert Scirocco's office, called the Mount Olive Press. And this guy put an article out that the headline was, "Kinnelon couple fake Alzheimer's and steal $980,000 from elderly mother."
Oh, my God.
And in the article, they mention elder abuse. So, of course, the ombudsman's office, they get those key words, and it goes up on their website. The lawyers put it on their website as marketing collateral, right? Hey, listen, look it. We got this.
Mm-hmm.
We rescued this. What was it?
Victory
in Elder Care was their title.
So, I see.
We are just, and then when it goes in a little newspaper, then NewJersey.com, which is the Star Ledger, the big newspaper in New Jersey, they pick it up, and it goes all over. It's viral, okay? I've got people in my town looking at us crooked like, oh, my God, like those Femias.
Yeah.
Because in the article was every little piece of information that we had a house at the shore, that my husband worked for Glatt Air Technologies as a vice president, that I worked at, and the only thing that saved us here was that they made a mistake on the name of the company where I worked, and they had my previous employer. But the next day after the article ran, and we don't know, right after the article, so what ended up happening was my husband gets brought into the HR department of his company where he had worked for
May 13th.
Yeah, on May 13th, they walked him into HR and they said, "You're fired." There was this article.
Oh,
and
good. Oh,
the name of the company was mentioned. He had worked there for many years, and they said, you know, it makes, you know, you're in pharmaceuticals, you're in regulatory affairs, you're in, and it makes, it looks fishy. You know what I mean? It's just, you're dragging the company name. It was a German family owned company. And he was let go. He was escorted out. It wasn't like, hey, here's 2 weeks. It was, that's it.
Yeah.
So we called the lawyer. So he loses his job. I didn't lose my job because they had the wrong company in there. But I can assure you, if they had the right company, I would have been out of work. So we would have had no medical benefits. And the next day, they issued a judgment against us because we were going to appeal the decision. The lawyer, of course, said, yeah, we need to appeal this. You're going to win if we can get it to the next level. And so we were going to appeal it. And so we were keeping the house money because we knew once we gave the money over that would immediately, they'd be on the spending spree. Because now, by the way, the nursing home was charging my mother $8,000 a month, not the agreed upon price.
Wow.
And so at this point, they put a judgment against me. They were going to garner my wages, and they wiped all my bank accounts that I had also with my children. And my son was on a ship in the Middle East and had no access to money. How about that?
Oh, my God.
So we had everybody in town whispering about us. My husband lost his job for the very first time in his entire life, okay, from when he had his first little job when he was 14. He never lost a job. And basically we lost it, and they basically told us if we want to sue we had to hire a defamation attorney that took care of getting the articles taken down and retracted. We had to have the lawyer, we changed the lawyers at that point to a more expensive firm, and they basically said, you can appeal it, but what happened was that my mother was the trustee of our family trust. So in a way, we were lucky the lawyers didn't really understand that, okay? And so what ended up, because my mother wasn't going to be able to explain it at this point. So at that point, the lawyer said, our lawyer said, you got to get her off that trust. Because if you don't, her lawyers can actually take your homes and sell them from underneath you. Because they will tell her, you go ahead and, you know, they'll do all the paperwork and just make her sign, right? Because technically she was competent. Well, luckily, and so they said, well, the three ways you take somebody off an irrevocable trust is they die, they resign, or they basically you have to get them removed. And they said, if we have to get her removed, we're going to go before Judge Coburn again, and you're going to lose. So, you know, more money. I mean, at this point, we were well into the over $100,000, $160,000 with both lawyers. So it just, you know, and we're down in income. I mean, it was crushing. And the fact that I couldn't see my mother. So I did not see my mother from the day of the trial. And she ended up dying in 2016, so for 3 years. They had her completely isolated. They were spending down. I did have to eventually, in order, we settled with them. Can't discuss the exact details of the settlement, but basically she resigned off the trust, thank God. And we had to put the $575,000 from the house in an escrow account that her lawyer controlled, and she was allowed to withdraw $10,000 per month. And I said, they're going to keep her alive until they go through all that money, right? So at that point, we moved away. We sold our house. We moved to our other house. And there was no need to have this house, this mother-daughter set up at this point. I didn't know whether my mother was alive or sick or dead or what. And when we moved, the lawyer that had the account in escrow, he would send, like, every month a thing that showed that she was taking the $10,000 out. And then when we moved, the forwarding, mail forwarding ended. So, you know, we weren't getting any more mail from there. And he knew, because obviously it was sent back to him. So about 4 months before my mother died, that lawyer, not Robert Scirocco, but Richard Deignan, went and he went to submit to try to become her guardian. So a neighbor had told me, hey, I a piece of mail arrived for you from the courthouse by mistake in my mailbox, and you may want to look at it. It looks important. So I go and open it, and lo and behold, it was the petition for guardianship for my mother, and I was listed on there, you know, with my old address as, a daughter that is the estranged daughter who wanted no
estranged,
part of my mother.
Estranged, yes.
So it was all in writing. So that's if they were portraying it that way to the court. So I wrote a letter to the judge, and this is a new judge now because Coburn retired. And I wrote a letter saying I'd like to appear in court because now I would like to get guardianship. And reading this whole thing, I could see how much money was left because he had to like list all the things. So there was the long and the short of it is there's about $400,000 that's unaccounted for. And on that was listed that my mother had a prepaid death plan. So I actually contacted the funeral home that she had established that in. Of course, her lawyers did all that. And he told me, he said, your story is so sad. And he said, when I get the call that she passed, I will call you. Because the nursing home wouldn't have called me. The lawyers wouldn't have called me. I wouldn't have even known that she died. So he called me. And, about 22 days before she died, I went to court. And the new judge, I said, I would like to petition for guardianship because I'm her next of kin. And I've been prevented from seeing her. And he said, well, you know, we had a new court-appointed lawyer, a woman named Joanne Sorrentino, who interviewed your mother, and she asked her, do you want your daughter to be your guardian? And, of course, my mother at that point was 70 pounds, and I'm sure she really didn't – she couldn't even remember her grandchildren's names at this point. And she said, I don't know. She's like, I don't know if I can trust her. So she doesn't know what she's saying. And then she said, well – do you know that Richard Deignan is trying to be your guardian? And she's like, I don't know. She goes, I don't remember my lawyer's names. I know one of them is married to Mary. That was Robert Scirocco. And she says, but I do know that, she goes, somebody should be really watching over the lawyers because to make sure that they're not spending my money. So Like, she didn't know what was going on, and she couldn't remember the lawyers or the grandchildren's names. But so my children at that point were adults, and I said, well, if you don't want – so the judge said, so if she says she doesn't want you, then we shouldn't have you as the guardian. And I said, well, why not a public guardian? Why does it have to be him? What about my children? My three children are all adults now. And so he said, oh, well, maybe we should look at the children. Well, coincidentally, Joanne Sorrentino didn't really want that. Because, of course, she wanted Richard Deignan to be appointed because he's another lawyer, right? And so she actually said her kids are at the her sons are in the Merchant Marine Academy. They travel. They're not going to be able to be an appropriate guardian. And so I said they're military officers. And I had done a little homework on Joanne Sorrentino, and it turns out that her son was at the Merchant Marine Academy and had been thrown out. So basically, there was animosity there. And Richard Deignan wanted to be her guardian because he had full control of her assets as it was. And the other thing is that the long and the short of it is I didn't get to be her guardian. My kids didn't get to be her guardian. This is the second time around. And they appointed Richard Deignan her guardian, and she died 22 days later. I did get notification from the nurse from the funeral home. When I went to plan out her service, they said that both lawyers wanted to attend because they were like family to her. And I said, if they show up here, I don't want them near my mother. They've had her for 3 years captive, essentially, and away from us. So when I went to clean out my mother's room in the nursing home, I found not a single picture of my kids anywhere, but there were pictures of her with Robert and Mary Scirocco out to dinner and Christmas cards with all the family pictures of Richard Deignan and Robert Scirocco. And I found an envelope hidden in her closet that was marked personal from Robert Scirocco's office. And inside, are you ready for this? This was creepy.
Okay.
Inside was like all sorts of newspaper articles downloaded from the internet and the actual paper newspaper articles saying that we faked this Alzheimer's and, you know, that we stole the money. And it had FYI on it. I still have it. And like when my one son became an Eagle Scout, it went in the newspaper. When my house went up for sale, you know how there's like the for sale that's listed online on Zillow. And they had all those things. Now, my mother didn't know computers. So somebody was like kind of feeding her and saying, look at your grandson. They're all out there getting successful and graduating from service academies. And you're not invited. I'm sure that that was part of the brainwashing and grooming to say, look how they've just abandoned you. So my mother, when I went to clean out the room, I said to one of the nurses, I said, you know, well, at least she died in her sleep. I mean, she was only 70 pounds. The nurse says to me, well, she didn't die in her sleep. We found her on the floor. She fell out of bed. So I run back to the room and I looked. Guess what? She was in a bed with no rails. Now, her guardian should have made sure that she was in a nice, like, you know, appropriate bed if she was feeling dizzy and she was only 70 pounds and weak. He also had arranged for hospice care during the day, but not at night, and she fell out of the bed shortly after midnight. So I had to
clean
out
her room. Can I say something?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead. I found out some years back here, about 4 or 5 years ago, that this thing of putting them in a bed with no railing has become standard procedure, especially if they're active and trying to get out of bed, or they, you know, toss and turn a lot. Some of them sleepwalk, or you know what I'm saying. But they stopped putting rails on the bed, and their excuse for it was, they could get caught in them and strangle themselves, or they could get their head caught in them and the rest of the body fall out of bed, and they basically, it's like hanging. The thing is, nobody uses those iron rails anymore that look like fencing.
Oh.
It's all solid plastic. Yeah. Plastic, it looks like boxing. They don't use, so when that is absent, especially in an older person, that is active at night, and many of them are, especially if they do have Alzheimer's or some kind of disease. They'll sundown, they'll do all kinds of things. They won't put those rails on there. It's a very convenient way to get rid of people. And, it also, go ahead.
Well, so after all of this, my oldest son was her executor. That was also part of the settlement that when she resigned off the trust, because Robert Chiracco wanted to be her her executor, conveniently. But anyway, so after everything, we had to wait until the remaining money that was left to settle the estate. After that was done, my husband and I, we made ethics claims against Robert Chiracco, Joanne Sorrentino, and Richard Deignan. And we had all this evidence, you know, all the things I'm telling you, but like also the monetary stuff, the fact that Richard Deignan was signing checks, undue influence, you know, the whole nine yards. There was tons of stuff that we had. And it takes a lot of time to go before the ethics board. You know, you're basically going to court again without the price of a lawyer. And they each one by one, and they took a year to review the whole thing. And basically they said that they didn't do anything unethical. So that didn't work.
Yes.
I went to the police about the fact that there was no jewelry left. And they said, well, you know, she had it in her possession. And, you know, we asked the lawyers and they said that they didn't know where it was. Well, of course not. And then I also tried to get in touch with the Attorney General's office, and you have to fill out a form online. And I didn't get very far with that. I did try to get an article in AARP. It was written out, ready to go, and it was shelved right before it was ready to be published in AARP magazine.
Yeah.
So it did go into Next Avenue, but it certainly didn't give all the information that I just told you, because, you know, I'm sure that, you know, it was more of a financial story, and that's why it made its way to Forbes. But, mm-hmm. you know, they say, you know, why didn't you have a PO? You know, I've had people comment on them, like, why didn't you have a POA? Why didn't you have an – and the reason was because there was no financial hidden agenda for us. I mean, my mother,
right.
There was just me. My husband was the executor of her will from, like, when right after my father died. We had new wills made up, all of us. And my husband was her executor. And when my father passed away, my father was very, very close with my husband. He said to him, you must take care of my wife and my daughter. And you must be careful because my wife is very naive. And, you know, she's foreign and she might fall into the wrong hands and you know,
mm-hmm.
believe people that may not have her best interests at hand. And what ends up happening is the complete nightmare that happened. So I'm going to let my husband make a couple of comments. I mean, do you have anything to add
okay.
as far as...
Well, one of
well,
the things that
you
I'd like to point out... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead, Robert.
No, one of the things I'd like to point out is that, you know, the opposition, you know, the opposition legal counsel, you know, their whole mantra throughout the course of this was that we were these conniving, monstrous people that had all sorts of nefarious intentions around my mother-in-law's finances. And we were unable to even convince our own attorney, missed the whole point that you don't put somebody in a position of major authority as far as command over the family finances, such as having them on grantor-retained interest trusts, as the person that has the ability to make the decision about when the property is sold and how much it's sold for. My mother-in-law had that authority by being on our grantor retained interest trusts that one of which was, you know, held each one of our houses. And she had that for decades, literally. Why would you ever mm-hmm. attempt to do something that would be unkind or just downright bad with someone who holds so much authority within the framework of your family finances? Okay. Everything we did was based upon trust, mutual respect, and the whole scenario just spun out of control
when these two attorneys got her ear and convinced her that we were out to harm her in every way you could imagine.
And by the way, that family trust was primarily our own finances, the money that my husband
right.
and I earned. It was all our money because that money from the sale of her house really never went into the trust until I moved it in there because I could see that the lawyers, I used to call it rampant spending. That's what my lawyer used to cringe when I used to say it. I said, the nursing home and these lawyers, they're going to get, once they get a hold of any money, it's going to be rampant spending because
yes.
they're going to make up things and raise the price of the nursing home. They could be charging, you know, they could say they're with her 10 hours a day for all we know at, you know, $500 an hour. And there goes the money.
And there was something
yes.
else that was at play here that was even more sinister, was that Mr. Scirocco, at the end of the trial, made a motion to have the proceedings of the guardianship trial deemed a frivolous lawsuit. Okay. Now, what that would have done is if it had in fact been deemed a frivolous lawsuit, they, meaning my mother-in-law's attorneys, would have been able to pursue us for financial damages that my mother-in-law
yes.
could have claimed that she suffered. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only thing that the judge did, and by the way, this cost us another $40,000 for our attorney to defend us on the point of it not being a frivolous lawsuit. They were able to successfully convince the judge that it was not a frivolous lawsuit. Had that not happened and it did get converted into a frivolous case, God only knows what types of lawsuits they would have brought against us for, psychological trauma.
Yeah.
Who knows what they would have,
mm-hmm.
who knows what they would have claimed against us. And one of the benefits that, you know, one of the only things we had going for us in this case was that the judge told them at the conclusion of the guardianship trial that he could not levy against our LLC trust where our assets were kept. I don't think they understood
okay.
it, thankfully, but they definitely had their eye on our assets because, unfortunately,
yes.
our lawyer revealed what our worth was at the start of the trial to show that we had no financial interest in it. It wasn't going to change our lifestyle, okay?
Right.
And, you know, in doing that, the floodgates were open for these two attorneys to start thinking about what else they could do to make even more money.
Oh, and by the
right.
way, they actually hired a witness or an expert to calculate. Now, are you ready for this? To calculate what my mother's hourly rate should have been to be the nanny of my children.
Oh, stop.
So,
I'm a great grandmother. I would never charge for keeping my grandchildren.
And
what
my
the?
Mother,
oh.
who my mother was raised by her own grandmother, and she would, because sometimes like some of my neighbors would say, oh, how much do you charge Trish for, you know, watching the kids? And my mother would go, I would never take money to watch my grandchildren. I mean, they were like,
right.
They made her feel better and her health improved when she was around them. And instead, they actually, like, they got someone in that was an expert, an employment expert or whatever, that went and said, okay, there were three kids, and she started watching this one from birth in 1992, and she was still watching them up until this time,
jeez.
Times three, times X amount of hours. It was unbelievable. It's like, are you kidding me? But, of course, you know, they weren't telling my mother, we're going to calculate to see how much money they actually owe you.
Yeah.
See, nobody came to me and said, how much is your hourly rate for, you know, doing all of her accounting and all of her care? You know, not that I would have ever charged, but, like, that's my point.
Right.
And they actually were saying that my mother also did seamstress work for us. Well, of course, she liked doing that. And they were like, oh, well, and then how much would it have cost you to pay a seamstress and this and that? We were very lucky. I mean, it could have gotten a lot worse. I mean, it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was a horrible thing to live through that I'll never get those last 3 years with my mother again. My husband lost his job.
It took him a while to find a new job. And, you know, the worry of, you know, all these articles in the news when you're interviewing for regulatory affairs positions with pharmaceutical companies. And my oldest son is a junior, and he was, you know, looking for employment with the military and in the maritime industry. Imagine Googling my husband's name, and if somebody's not really paying attention, they're like, what kind of a family does this guy belong to?
Yeah.
It's just,
right.
It snowballs all the things that come of this. I'd see cars drive by our house. We lived on a cul-de-sac. I got a lot of hang-up phone calls. I always looked over my shoulder getting in and out of my car to go to work because I go
you
to different
to.
Places. Oh, yeah. And these are the kind of people that, you know, basically got away with murder. They got away with murder.
Mm-hmm.
One other really interesting point about, you know, going back a bit in the conversation to when my wife conveyed that she had to turn over the savings bonds that she was listed as a co-owner on. The moment the attorneys cashed them in, as my wife noted, there was a huge tax penalty that my mother-in-law had to pay. But the next event that took place was that these same attorneys who assured my mother-in-law that they were not going to charge her handed her bills totaling almost $100,000, okay? And the Judge Coburn approved the payment of their fees. So my mother-in-law had to surrender most of what the face value of those bonds was worth within the space of a week.
Yes.
Oh, my God. And, you
awful.
Know, you talk about a power of attorney and medical power of attorney, and I see people all these years, they've got legal instruments in place that they think are going to protect them, that should protect them. But you can get into one of these tribunals, and they discard them. In fact, many laws now, well, shouldn't say laws, statutes, read that the hearing examiner, magistrate, whatever they're calling themselves in these kangaroo courts, these civil tribunals, can discard those at will. If they see them as an obstacle, they don't ever say an obstacle to what, but I can only assume it's to people raiding the estate. So all of that estate planning and preparation is for nothing. These courts were set up specifically to work this system. And it's being done globally. We know it's being done globally. The same system is in place in many, many countries. We've got I-Corps selling franchises on how to set up conservator and guardianships and promising fast, easy, and consistent money. Guess where that's coming from? And so you see, this is a whole, it's a global thing that's going on in every supposed civilized country, every westernized country. This process is in place, and it is a culling of the elderly, but with the theft of wealth from the family. People are being disinherited.
It is no different than an international cartel. I used to think of it when I was much more naive as something along the lines of a cottage industry, but it goes way beyond that. As you point out, it is global in the scope of the situations in which it's happening. And the bottom line is that there really is no set of, legal protective measures that you can take that's going to cover every possible situation.
That's that way intentionally. Yes, it's that way intentionally. Go ahead.
What the listeners need to understand is that the one thing that we took away from this is that at all costs in these types of situations with your loved ones, you must keep attorneys out of the situation. Somehow,
yes.
you must keep attorneys, judges, nursing homes even, you've got to keep them out of the situation because the nursing homes are a very important part of this whole organization of this cartel that basically feeds these victims to attorneys.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, and that is the thing, too. You get these attorneys involved in this, and the game is on. Once they're involved, the game is on. Over these years, I have seen families take out second and third mortgages on their home, fighting to get mom, dad, or whomever back. Their marriages fall apart. Kudos to the two of you for hanging in there. I've seen people spend their kids' as college funds trying to get, spending far more in many cases than what the estate was actually worth. It isn't the estate they're fighting for. It's that parent. It's that loved one that they're fighting for. I cannot wrap my head around how much of a lowlife you have to be to trade in this, to know that you caused this much misery and this much harm to people, and because out of greed, out of a sense of empowerment, I guess there's nothing greater than knowing you own another human being. And if you can steal them, you know, rob them blind while you take that ownership, I guess it's a double good thing. But this whole system is set up. We've seen these bills come out. Last year it was S-178, the Elder Justice and Protection Act or some such nonsense, did absolutely nothing. A reiteration of state and federal law and wiretap and, you know, mail fraud. But in the middle of it was the part that everybody should have paid attention to. And it said, to further protect our elderly, we're going to further fund and empower. And here is a list of every one of these agencies we fight and a bunch more. Then we come up this year with S-591. And, oh, and everybody's crowing about this bill. How wonderful it is. This bill does nothing. And what is absent is there is no law, and Congress will not create a law. Neither will your state legislature. Will they create a law that specifically cites these predatory activities by these individuals, these guardians and attorneys, as a crime? And until they do that, we haven't got a leg to stand on. Because you can say all day long, because what they're running on is statute. Statute is always an artificial construct used to void the Constitution and the common law. So you have this whole system in place where the cards are stacked in their favor. You can't charge them with anything because there's no crime cited. There's no crime code that would go with it, no legal code that would go with it that you could use to enforce it. There's no punishment or penalty. And this bill that just came out is the same way. There is no protection in it whatsoever. It says they encourage the states to develop more statutes. No, we don't need more statutes. We need a criminal law criminalizing this kind of activity. And
We also need some meaningful legislation that addresses the really onerous situation of if you have a legitimate claim, to seek guardianship of a loved one because of things like dementia, Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. bipolar disorder. You know, when you have legitimacy around the possible existence of those conditions in a loved one, that should immediately prompt guardrails to go up around the exertion of undue influence on these people by attorneys. And there is absolutely nothing that, that's even in the planning stages that would protect against that. And the situation I always recall when I think of this particular topic is at one point in very early 2013, I think it was either late January, probably around late January, my wife and I went to visit my mother-in-law at the nursing home on a Saturday evening. And I remember mm-hmm. it quite vividly because we went there immediately after we ate dinner. It was probably about 7 o'clock in the evening that we got there. And we go up to the front desk and say, we're here to see Ada Vocino. And they call up to the room that she's in and they tell us, well, she can't come down to see you. She has a visitor. Okay, and we said, well, what uh-huh. visitor? On a Saturday night? And they said, Mr. Scirocco is in her room with her. Okay,
oh.
So you've got her attorney in the room of an 89-year-old woman on a Saturday night, okay? And my mother-in-law actually came down from the room to speak with us, but Mr. Scirocco would not come downstairs, okay?
Oh.
To me, this speaks volumes to the character of this person who basically, knowing that we're there, is hiding in the room of an 89-year-old woman in a nursing home, okay?
Right.
What is he doing there on a Saturday night? this woman is, you know, is suffering from dementia. She's been diagnosed with dementia and bipolar disorder. If this is not undue influence, I just don't understand what is. And why don't we have, why don't we have legislation in place to protect against this type of abuse?
Every time we have tried to get legislation that would address this problem, particularly the Bar Association, the Elder Law Attorneys Association, the Nursing Home Association, the Guardianship Association, and everybody else that bleeds these estate drives and preys on these people, runs in the back door with big, giant campaign contributions and a clear message: if you want more money, you need to shelve this bill. And this is exactly what goes on. One of my problems with government as it exists today is we have no representation. Everybody's for sale. Everybody is for sale. And it doesn't make any difference what's right or what's wrong. One of the things out in D.C. Was brought up to me more than once was, you know, I don't think they all know, Marty. I don't think. Yeah, they know. Every one of them knows exactly what's going on. And not one of them will address it honestly.
The point you just raised has actually been, you know, fielded by Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch recently. He's written extensively, very recently, on the lack of civility and the lack of civil justice in the current justice system in America for the average American. And I think this is one of the most egregious examples of that lack of what I continue to refer to as guardrails in how we need to protect the elderly and we need to protect the rights of the family.
Right. And, you know, people talk about the American family. I hear people talking about gay people, for God's sake, destroying the traditional American. They have no power to do so. The people that are destroying the family, the traditional family, is your own government through these agencies and agents and attorneys. That's who's destroying them. That's who's kidnapping children. Go ahead.
They use groups such as alternate lifestylers to cover their own insidious activities.
Yes. Yes, exactly. As long as you stay focused on them, you'll have somebody to be angry at and somebody to fight and somebody to blame without ever looking at the real culprit. I've told people this repeatedly. They don't have the power to do anything to you. Two people that you don't know and never will, getting married of the same sex has no bearing on you whatsoever. But that person sitting in that office with a title, that's the person that's going to cause harm to you. That's who's going to destroy your family. It's going to take it apart. Like I say, on the one end, they're snatching 800,000 kids a year and fostering them out and doing forced adoptions. It's all for money. They get paid for every bit of that. And on the other end is our elderly and the disabled. And they're trafficking them. And that's who's, your own case is a perfect example of ripping a family apart for monetary gain. That's all this is about, is you've got something they want. They've decided should belong to them. And all the cards are stacked in their favor. Even though you know what they've done is criminal, there is no law. There is no law that makes it a crime so that you can.
I often think about looking back about like at those final hours or moments in terms of my mother, how confused and, you know, alone she must have felt. Even if they, you know, when they would come and see her and say, you know, your daughter doesn't come around, it had to have, even no matter how ill you are, there is a little bit of acknowledgement, you know, where, you know, they're sundowning in the evening, but like there are moments of lucidity. And I just can't imagine how confused and really confused my mother was at the end that she was there all by herself, you know, and
exactly.
Where was
terrorized.
Her family? Yeah.
Well, you have done it, you know, as an older person to have this happen to you at the most vulnerable stage of your life. Never are you more vulnerable than you are when you're an elderly. And to have this happen and everything happening around you without you having any say in anything, this is another part of this grooming process. is they make them feel empowered. Well, you're the one actually making the decision. We're going to do what you want, but we're, you know, here's the thing. Your family's not coming to see you. Do you really want them in charge of everything? Do you really want them having control? You see, they're not here. Would you rather have us? You know, we're the ones coming to see you. You know, it's kind of grooming. This is no different than a pedophile grooming a child for sex. It's the same methodology that's occurring there. Patricia, we've got about 5 minutes here left.
Yes.
What would you like to say closing this up?
Well, do you have anybody that has questions, or did you have any other questions that you can ask of us?
You have, you answered as people were listening in here, were sending messages asking questions, but you covered them. You know, how did they get this done? You know, who was the judge that you saw? And were there other families? And, of course, there is always other families. One of the most insidious parts of this is convincing families, well, this must be an isolated incident. Well, you must have done something wrong or they wouldn't have done this. You didn't have to do anything
or
wrong.
Or we had the Monday morning quarterbacks that would be saying, you know, well, why don't you try this? And what about this? Or, you know, why don't you sue? Why didn't your husband sue for Sue Glatt Air Techniques for, wrongful termination.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the lawyer said, sure, we can handle that. We have a department just for employment law, but it's going to take a year or two, and it's going to be dragging it into the news over and over again. And if you're in a job search, I mean, it's all about money. Yeah, sure, if you want to throw another $100,000 towards it. They said if we appealed, it would be another $200,000. It's just, cost after cost.
Well, and you
after
know
cost.
Something, Patricia? Exactly. Why should it cost us everything we've got just to access the judicial system, the supposed law? You know, why should it cost us that?
I will say this though.
When
you go to the ethics board to report the attorneys. It's something that doesn't cost anything. The person reporting doesn't need a lawyer. And when I was talking to one of the attorneys that was reviewing the whole ethics thing, he said, you know, people should realize that you can't use the ethics committee as a free means of punishing a lawyer just for revenge. And I said, I'm not here to punish them. I'm here before a committee that is supposed to be non-biased. And what is the purpose of it? It's not for a punishment. It's to see if there are lawyers doing unethical
finding
things.
Fact. Yes.
Right. It's fact finding. But when we did it, when we went to have Richard Deignan investigated, he hired a very expensive law firm in New Jersey to defend him. And so it was just interesting how he had to – why did he go and hire a law firm to defend him in that? Well, you know, he must have been a little worried. And we thought we had excellent evidence, right? I mean
– right.
Well, in that case,
right.
we had his signature on checks – that were from my mother-in-law's account that he was writing and signing his own name to, and he did not have conservatorship or power of attorney or that was before he had guardianship over my mother-in-law, and the ethics committee didn't find anything unusual about that. And going back to an earlier comment you made about why does it cost so much for us to have access to the judicial system to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we were going through the whole thing post-trial where we had to hire a separate attorney to handle the defamation issues that were the fallout of the guardianship trial, you know, I made a comment to the attorney once that, you know, these bills are really high and I'm not working now. And he looked at me and without skipping a beat, he says, well, you know, lawyers have to eat too.
Yeah, they're eating damn good.
But they eat
I've
well.
Got less than 60 seconds. Yes, I've got 60 seconds left here. I want to thank you both for coming on and talking about this. I know it's painful, and it's never going to go away, I don't think. But we'll keep trying. But, again, thank you for being my guest this evening.
And hopefully, hopefully some victims in New Jersey will come forward. And because I'm sure it's going on all over.
It is. It is. Tomorrow evening, we have Gretchen Hammond coming on. She's going to talk about what's been going on since her expose on Michigan probate, which it looks like things are coming apart up there as a result. So if you want to tune in for that, she'll be on with tonight. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Patricia and Robert, thank you. And good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.